Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today we're back to the gods of war, and today I've got some very simple but important things to tell you. And it's going to be one of the few times where you can actually see that what happens in warfare and how it can be applied in real life and how important it is to apply it. However, we need to start with a little bit of music. And it's a French military march called Victory is Ours. And the French did have a lot of victories, most especially in the time of Napoleon. So here is some lovely European military music.
My enemies are many, my equals are none. In the shade of olive trees, they said Italy could never be conquered. In the land of pharaohs and kings, they said Egypt could never be humbled. In the realm of forest and snow, they said Russia could never be tamed. Now they say nothing. They fear me, like a force of nature, a dealer in thunder and death. I say, I am Napoleon. I am Emperor.
I hope you enjoyed that. The first French Empire was under Napoleon, And technically, it lasted about 10 to 11 years, because there was a time when Napoleon abdicated and he went off to the island of Elba. But then Napoleon came back. And behind all of these stories are very, very fascinating things. We'll get to them. But the first French Empire lasted from 1804 to 1814, and then Napoleon was on Elba, and then Napoleon came back for the campaign of Waterloo, which is where he was finally defeated. But like I say, behind all of these things are very fascinating stories, and there are many things about history, including military history, which appear to be carved in stone, but in actual fact, when you look at it more closely, you'll see that there could have been other outcomes. But we're not going to concern ourselves with that today. And I hope that my Napoleon introduction caught you off guard. I got that footage from a game that I used to play quite a lot. And I loved that intro of Napoleon. There weren't cameras or recording devices back then, but that introduction to that game is perhaps the closest that I can find to maybe giving a bit of an idea of what Napoleon was like. Though I think it's maybe a little bit overdone. Napoleon could be very diplomatic when he needed to be. But he did have a pride in what he did. And you'll find that white men who engage in all kinds of fantastic things, whether they are inventing or whether they are just doing their daily jobs, whatever it may be, you'll see that men who take their work seriously, whatever that work is, that they have a lot of pride in it. And women should be the same. My own mother used to have pride in the things that she did, and it's something that comes naturally to me as well. And I think it's a fun part of life, and I think it's a very good part of life for whites. Christians will say that pride is a bad thing. I don't see it like that at all. I think pride is a good thing. It is a sign of someone who takes a thing seriously, and they give it their everything. Even if their everything doesn't look that great, they know that they put a lot of effort in, and they are proud of their effort. And you'll find that pride exists among all whites. All whites everywhere are proud of their own nations. They take pride in their achievements as individuals, their achievements as a group. And of course, we should have pride in the race. In all of us together, our race has done awesome things. Our race might even be the greatest thing in the universe. That's a topic for another day. And I think Ben Clarkson would agree with that. Ben Clarkson said some wild things himself. Anyhow, I kind of enjoyed that Napoleon intro because it gives a little bit of a rougher edge to the male, which is very important. The white male has to have his rough edge. He has to be a wolf. He has to be someone that you don't mess with. And that's very important. So just a few things about Napoleon and the First French Empire. The French Revolution started in 1789. But all the other European monarchies didn't like this idea of the French tossing out their king. And there are some similarities in this to the Germans. So anyhow, when the French people had tossed out their king and queen, lots of the other European countries were already hostile to them. And in the end, it came to blows in 1792, with the French declaring war on Austria. But the Austrians were already getting ready to smack the French. And this eventually expanded with the Prussians also diving in and attacking France. So ultimately, from 1792 until 1814. 1792 until 1814. The French were literally at war almost non-stop. They were at war almost non-stop for 22 years. And that is when Napoleon abdicated. But then he came back in 1815 and did the Waterloo thing. So in total, the French fought 23 years. And that is something to sit and think about. 23 years of almost non-stop warfare. They'd have peace for short periods of time, and then the next war starts. So the First French Empire was quite something in terms of the amount of fighting that took place. And we will still take a good look at that, and you'll be amazed how brutal it was. But if it wasn't for Napoleon, the French would never have lasted that long. If it wasn't for Napoleon, they would have collapsed after a couple of years. The one thing that you can say about the French Revolution and how it ties back to Hitler is that you had something new that popped up. Now, the involvement of jury and whether it was good or bad, I'm not going to go into that. It has got some similarities to the American Revolution. But the difference was that America basically only had to fight the British and get rid of the British. And otherwise, the Americans didn't have other big enemies nearby. However, the French were sitting in Europe and everyone around them was pissed off with this concept. And so the wars against the French were basically aimed at merely trying to get the monarchy back in charge of France again. That was the basic thing. And in that sense, it's similar to Hitler, because Hitler did something. In this case, Jewry hated it. Global Jewry went berserk at the thought of being expelled from Germany. And they basically brought the whole world in to smash Hitler in order to put the status quo back in place. That, in a nutshell, is what happened to Hitler. And so, in both cases, you've got something new that's happened. It's pissing off someone, and everyone's trying to put the genie back into the bottle because they don't want this thing to spread. So the lesson of that for us with regard to Hitler is that moving forward into the future, just be aware that the reason why we in the white right take so much heat is because of the fear that what Hitler did is going to spread, because that is Jewry's greatest nightmare. But for us, the goal is it must spread. In the same way that, let's say, quotes, democracy spread, so too should National Socialism. And I'm convinced that this is the future. So anyhow, the bottom line with both Napoleon and Hitler is that they are the guys who are doing something new. In the case of Napoleon, he didn't create the French Revolution, but he's merely someone there who ends up finding that his fighting skills are in critical need. If he doesn't win battles, France will collapse and be swallowed by its enemies, and they'll shove an unpopular monarchy back in charge. Now, I'm not against kings or dictators or emperors or anything like that. I'm just telling you what was going on in history. I think everything has its place and has its uses. There's a time for everything. What we're going to discuss today is about warfare and battles. And the way I want to approach this is by showing you stuff and asking you to observe and then pointing out some things to you. Thanks to Jewry and liberalism, we've become so insanely stupid that we have completely and utterly forgotten the lessons of history that our forefathers knew 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago. Jewry has been so hard at work bringing rampant stupidity to the Western world. And today I want to tackle an important topic that all white men need to understand. And once you understand this, you will look around the world with new eyes and you'll start seeing new patterns you've never noticed before. So here's another little musical video interlude. All of you are familiar with my signature tune for History Reviewed, but not many of you have seen the video behind the signature tune. And so that's what I'm going to play for you now. It is 4.5 minutes long, and it's a little video that I got off a website that I don't think exists anymore. They used to produce all these excellent short videos, but they wanted to be paid for all their videos, and I think that's what killed them. But they produced brilliant videos. Their short videos were brilliant, and this one blew my mind. And this one is my signature tune. And my signature tune is called Day of the Wolves. Day of the Wolves. This is my signature tune. Take a look at it, because this is what I'm hoping our future is. This is the kind of stuff that I hope comes true in our lifetimes. So now you know what my signature tune really represents, eh? And I love that video. Isn't that an awesome video? It's a fantastic video. We need the new wolves, and the new wolves need to get rocking to clean up the Western world and to get things back under the control of the white man. So if you'll look on the screen in front of you, you can see that AI and I have been doing some work. And I'm having a lot of fun thanks to a guy who's named Theodore. Theodore knows who he is. And thanks to him, I'm now starting to play with some nice images like those that you see on the screen in front of you. How cool is my Make Rome Great Again? And to the right of it, you'll see a tiger tank and a whole lot of fighting. That's the new Roman army. That's exactly what we need. Anyone who tells you that you need peace forever, just remind them that the Romans, who produced the greatest civilization, the greatest political entity, and the longest lasting political and social structure in the Western world, that the Romans fought for 1,200 years. 1,200 years, the Romans fought anybody and everybody. They fought hundreds of wars, depending on how you count a war. And they fought large numbers of rebellions, wars from people outside their state. The Romans fought a lot. And 1,200 years of war was working very well for them. So I say, let's make Rome great again. Because that's exactly what Hitler was doing. And Napoleon himself was a great student of the Romans and the Greeks, just like Hitler. And if it was good enough for them, it should be good enough for the rest of us. All the old rotten rubbish, that is the Jews, liberals, and all their assorted fools that go along with them, they like to pretend that war is only for stupid people. There is that quote from the disgusting rotten Jew Henry Kissinger, where he says that soldiers are stupid. That is typical of your Jewish arrogance, that soldiers are stupid. This is not the case at all. And if you really intend to fight to win, you can't win if you're an idiot. And all these people who talk about peace forever, all that kind of stuff, they're all barking up the wrong tree. The truth of the matter is that life is intense and it's very competitive. And now we've got enemies all around us. We've got enemies all around us. We are basically all stuck in some form of multiracial state where your neighbor can very likely be a racial enemy. So in all that business and Jewish liberal thinking, they always poo-poo military stuff, poo-poo military men, and they like to pretend that anyone who fights is an idiot. But in actual fact, if you want to have a state and you want a state that's going to last, you need to fight to create the state, and you will need to fight to keep the state alive. And that is going to be the future for everybody. Even the states that we have and the positions that we have, we will have to struggle and fight to hold on to our stuff. And if the white man wants to go anywhere, the white man's going to have to learn how to defeat other people in battle. And you will discover that our race, as in everything else, our race knows what they're doing. I did do a video about how old ancient armies were superior to modern armies. I did a whole video about that, to show the methods by which ancient whites were superior to modern whites militarily in the way that they did things. And I want to tell you, when you look at the Romans, like that image on the screen in front of you, When you look at the Romans, as I will show you later, you are looking at the cleverest army that ever existed. The Roman army was the cleverest army that ever walked the face of the earth. There is no army that had a higher IQ than the Roman army. Everything that our race does, and the stuff that comes naturally to us, is that we do not engage in big things without thinking about it. Whether it is politics, whether it is about our values and the way that we live among ourselves, we always, always, always think ahead. We never just do anything willy-nilly. We've got our rules. We know what it is that we want to do, and we know how we want to do it, and we expect people to function in a certain way. You'll see that our race is filled with forward-thinking stuff. We think about the future in every conceivable way. Whether it is warfare, whether it is politics, whether it's economics, whether it's medicine, law, or even the unknown, like the future. In the case of philosophy, we've got lots of philosophers who think deep thoughts, dig deeply into things before we do it. So the stuff that's kept away from you, the stuff that people have forgotten about, is that in warfare, we've also done a lot of thinking. We've done a lot of thinking about warfare, and we've thought about warfare from an intellectual point of view. What is it that we want to do? What is it that we want to achieve? We don't just run around like a bunch of bozos, just grabbing something and stabbing someone here and knocking someone over the head there. Everything we do always has a reason and a plan, and we know everyone's got to do these tasks. We're doing these tasks because that is the outcome that we want over there, etc. So the question is, in warfare, what is it that you really want to do? When we say we want to fight a war and we want to win a war, what do we mean by winning it? What is victory? What are we trying to achieve at the end of the day? And nowadays, in the so-called modern age, where you look at, let's say, a thing like the Russia-Ukraine war, where the Russia-Ukraine war has basically turned into something like World War I, where you've got hundreds of kilometers of front lines that are more or less static, and where everyone's talking about peace, and where it is clear that neither side is going to win in the traditional sense of the word. People therefore think that war has reached a point where this is it, it's not worth fighting because you can't achieve much, that you'll fight and fight and fight and fight and get nowhere. Now, in my World War III video that I did earlier this year, I spoke about a concept called cabinet wars, where I said that in Europe there was a thing known as a cabinet war. Now, cabinet wars were wars that were fought mainly in the 17th and 18th centuries, and mostly in the time of absolute monarchies, but these were wars that had limited objectives. And these wars were wars where neither the masses of the whites nor the army itself was actually very interested in the fighting. So it was a war that was like a war on paper, where the king has ordered the army to go and fight someone, but neither side is that keen on fighting each other. So they go through the motions of fighting, not many people get killed, and nothing big really comes of it. It's like a war that is fought with little energy, little effort, and people are going through the motions of it. But it's not like World War II, it's not like Napoleon, it's not like the Romans and the Greeks, where you've got all of society fired up. And all of society is fired up and you're going to land a punch on some enemy. And people want to win badly and the fighting is vicious. It's not like that. It's the opposite. It's a war that's been started between, let's say, two monarchies and neither of the soldiers on either side are very keen on fighting this war. And it's this half-hearted kind of affair. So that is a cabinet war. And these cabinet wars can be quite pathetic. So an army maneuvers around, they shoot a bit here, shoot a bit there. The two sides have got some clashes, but nothing serious comes of it. No really big action. It's really a slow motion kind of a thing. Nobody's too keen on fighting. Nobody's too keen on dying. Nobody's too keen even to kill the enemy. So it's a very much a lackluster kind of a war. Now, a lot of stuff in this quotes modern age, which really is more like a Weimar state for the whole of the Western world. In the modern age, everything is lackluster because people are starting to realize you're wasting your time with this, you're wasting your time with that. The people ruling your country are not really the people that you want. You don't like the direction in which the country is going. For many people, they'd rather be ruled by Vladimir Putin than be ruled by their own governments. They don't see anything that is really important to them, that they really want to grab onto, that they really want to win. So everything in the modern world is very much a cabinet war kind of a thing. And the wars themselves, except maybe for the Ukrainian side, the wars themselves are not that intense and people aren't that fired up. So we imagine in this day and age, we imagine that this is the way it's going to be for all time. However, I must tell you, as the years have gone by and I do things, I become ever more skeptical about all things that we think these days. And I will tell you that there is no reason at all to believe such rubbish, that in actual fact, there will be times in the future again when whites are alive and energetic and people are keen to win and to defeat others and to get their way again. So don't be fooled by the current state of things and think that we've entered a state that will always be like this for the next 500 years or 1,000 years. Not at all. When the time is right and people are fired up, people are going to get a lot of stuff done. So that's the first thing I want to get out of your head, is the notion that war is high-tech, super-specific. It is fought in this certain way. That's it. That's what the outcome is. It'll never be different. Not at all. Big scale mass fighting can come back in 101 different ways. And you'll see white armies rolling along just like before. In the same way that in the American Civil War, you had huge armies of whites getting stuck into each other and fighting intensely. In the future, one would hope that we are fighting other races. That's the key, to fight racial enemies. We don't want to get stuck into each other, but we want to get stuck into racial enemies, and that we'd want to do so on a big scale, not muck around, get the job done, get things done, move forward. So don't imagine that the future is pathetic and will always be a copy of the modern times. Not at all. The future can be very bright. The future can be very wild. It simply depends on the mood and the state of white people, of European people. When we're fired up again, we'll be getting stuck into others big time, okay? You'll be seeing very intensive stuff quickly. So don't imagine that for the rest of time that 90% of everybody is going to be sitting at home as a couch potato and that only a tiny percentage are going to be out in front in combat. Not at all. All kinds of things can change that. And among those things relate to the energy and determination of white men. So when you see guys like Napoleon and Hitler, both of them created what you could call armies of the people. And that's what we need again. The Romans were a similar kind of a people. The ancient Greeks, the pagans, the other whites, whether it's the Vikings, the Germans, the Celts, the Britons, whites in ancient times had their armies of the people, and we could get rocking and rolling. Armies of the people are very possible, and we can pack huge punches in the future. But we'll just have all kinds of different technology that enables that. So what I want to get out of your head is the notion that warfare in the future is just someone pressing a few buttons here and there, and that this is how future war will be. No, no, no. Future war can still be masses of troops, masses of units doing all kinds of things. It all depends on what it is you want to achieve. And you'll see why I'm mentioning these things as we move along. So in our civilization, we've had lots and lots of thinkers and great generals and great commanders who've given extremely deep thought to combat and to the purpose of war and what it is that you want to do. Now, you need to see war as a structure, as an organization. An army is an organization. It's got people at the top, people at the bottom, people in between. There are lots and lots of highly specialized things in an army, and the army functions as a team. It's like a football team or a soccer team, and everyone's got his place and everyone's got his task. Now, you could say that sport is a kind of ritualized combat. So in sport, you win because you've got rules and the rules allow you to score. So you've got rules that say, okay, if you are playing soccer, you want to kick the ball into the opposing side's goalpost. If it gets past the goalie and it gets in, then you've scored. And you're going to play for a certain period of time, and then whoever's got the highest score is the winner. So sport is ritualized combat, and it's ritualized combat with certain rules. In some cases, we just play with a ball that we kick, or a ball that we hold in our hands, or we've got a racket or a bat that we hit the ball with, but that's how we play that sport. In warfare, you have rules, but the rules are agreed upon sort of in a loose kind of a way. But on the whole, there are no rules. Ultimately, if you've got a new weapon that you can surprise the other side with, you go and you use it. So in warfare, you get all kinds of debates about what it is that you must do. And there have been debates about when you've got an army, what are you going to do with the army? What is the purpose of the army? How are you going to get victory? What do you need to achieve in order to get victory? Well, in the case of the real world, you don't have rules like soccer or football. So it's not something that runs for a particular period of time on a particular field. The playing field is across the borders of entire nations. Depending on how big the country is, you can even fight by way of other countries to get to the country that you really need to fight. So the rules are way more wider. Your strategies are much wider. You can do almost anything. If you think that it's easier to win by engaging in one strategy rather than another strategy, then you can do that. Ultimately, there are no rules. And whatever you can physically do, if you've got enough money, equipment, manpower, etc., your real question is, how do I organize my manpower and my weapons in order to achieve victory? And you can organize it in any way that you want. Like the French, after World War I, decided that they were going to build the Maginot Line, and that war was now high-tech and defensive, and that that was how they were going to approach it. Whereas the Germans came to the conclusion that the real weapon that came out of World War I that could be really useful is the tank, and that the tank could become a war-winning tool. Now that was the thinking of General Guderian, Heinz Guderian. He looked at a particular thing, which was basically the tank is nothing more than a motorized vehicle developed for war. That was the greatest idea that came out of motorized vehicles on the ground. And he said to himself, what can we do with this particular weapon? How can we use this weapon for maximum effect? So war has got very wide scope. In warfare, you can go after anything. In warfare, you can decide that you want to attack the enemy army, or you could say you want to attack the enemy civilians, or you can say that you want to attack their capital city or their cities, or you can say you want to cut off the supply lines to them, either the supply lines on land or the supply lines at sea. You've got very wide scope in how you can think. And of course, now that we've got aerial weapons, we've got additional methods of doing things. We can fire missiles. We can drop bombs. We've now got drones that can fly around. We are basically more and more entering the age of robots, robots and robot warfare. In many respects, we have already been doing robot warfare probably since World War I, where certain weapons were so sophisticated that in some respects they are already almost autonomous. Like in World War II, when you had the proximity fuse, on anti-aircraft guns, the proximity fuse detects when the shell is close to an aircraft and then it explodes. So the fuse itself decides when it's going to explode. In that sense, mines at sea, magnetic mines, for example, that sit quietly until the ship comes nearby and then it blows up. Those things have been around for over 100 years. So some of our weapons are already slightly robotic or have been slightly robotic already. We are entering an age where more and more weapons at a huge rate are going to become very robotic. And there are so many possibilities, I must tell you. There are so many possibilities. There's even other possibilities. But anyhow, the point is that in warfare, you've got lots and lots of options. And of course, the white man has got more options than anyone else. The white man's got huge amounts of options. But even if you go back to the time of the Romans and to Frederick the Great, Napoleon, etc., even in those times, they had lots of options and they could tackle things in many ways. Do we fight the enemy army? Do we besiege them? Do we cut off their supplies and starve them out? There are lots and lots of ways of using your troops and using all the equipment that you have. Now, Napoleon in particular focused his energy on destroying the enemy army. Napoleon reckoned that the thing that you need to aim for is the enemy army, that you must aim for the enemy army, because if you can't defeat that thing, then you can't win the war. Because as long as that army is there, it can fight you. So if you go after the civilians, but you ignore the army, you can go and murder a whole lot of civilians, but the army is still there. The army can still make moves. That army could maybe hit you in other ways while you are busy murdering civilians, for example. So you can do many, many things, but for Napoleon, it all boiled down to there's one thing you've got to get rid of, and that is the enemy's army. The enemy's army is the key element, is the key tool that can hurt you. The only thing that gives a nation or a group of people teeth is the army. The army is the only thing that can go and bite them. The army is the only thing that can go and bite them. The army is the only thing that can destroy things. It's the only thing that can kill people. It's the only thing that can stop other stuff. The army is like a man who's a boxer, and his fist is basically the army. It is his fist that is going to connect with the other side. Everything else he's got doesn't have the power to hit, but his fist is the thing that's going to connect with the other side. His fist is the thing that's going to damage the other side physically. Having scientists and managers and engineers and so forth is meaningless by itself. What is important is that at the end of the day, that their work results in something that gives you a fist that allows you to hit where you need to hit. So that is the purpose of the army. The army is the main structure in the state that allows the state to hit another state. Nowadays, they also talk about non-state actors, and they usually use this to refer to terrorist groups, etc. They talk about non-state actors, and non-state actors can have their own army as well. So your state can hit another state, but your state could hit non-state actors, or non-state actors having an army can hit a state and even take over a state and rule a state. All those things are things that happen nowadays. It does that because of all these tiny wars that we've had in recent times. But whites as a race, we mostly have our own states, except for us in South Africa, and we have the ability to smack someone. In the case of us in South Africa, we could become a non-state actor that hits a state, for example. So there are all kinds of possibilities. But at the end of the day, if you want to project power, you have to project it through the army. The army is actually the most important structure that defends you and allows you to exist and allows you to survive, beat up your enemies, and win. The army is the only thing there is. It is male power, and that thing is the thing that creates all other things. And if that structure falls apart, you can end up losing your country quickly. So the question is, what do you do with your army, and how do you do it? And what is it that you want to achieve with this thing in order to achieve, quotes, victory? Now, in some of my other videos, I've pointed out that in the modern age, we have gone down the stupid path of limited wars. This is especially true for the United States. Americans cannot think in any way except for limited objectives. But in Europe and in other places, we thought on a much bigger scale, where we thought of much bigger objectives. America, for example, does not think in terms of, let's go and conquer Mexico and make Mexico the next state in America. Yet, for white America to actually do that would actually be a piece of cake. But Americans have been conditioned to not think in those terms. But the truth is that whites can actually think more broadly, and you are not limited except by your power. The only thing that limits you is your power. How many people do you have? How strong is your science and your economy and your engineering? And off you go, man. Ben Clausen was onto this kind of thing, where he said whites can and should take any country that they want to take. They should take any piece of land on earth that they want to take. And Ben Clausen came to the conclusion, either whites are going to rule the world or we're going to lose. That was Ben Clausen's thinking. So the real question is, when you've got an army, what are you going to do with it? What is your goal? Napoleon reckoned you smash the enemy army. When you break the enemy army, that is how you're going to get victory. Linked to this is also the notion that you got to get your army to the enemy's capital city. that when you get your army to the enemy's capital city, that the capital city is like the heart or the brain, or maybe the heart and the brain of the nation. And if you can occupy the heart and brain of the nation, then all resistance will cease. So that is the sort of basic Napoleonic kind of thinking of how you win a war. But Napoleon's focus was the army. However, since then, among the thinking has been that capital cities need to be captured, because that is where you finish off the final resistance. So in warfare, you aren't limited by time, like in a sport, and there's nothing that tells people that the game is over. You can't say, "Ah, we've reached the top of the hour, the game is over now." In real warfare, there's no such thing. People can carry on fighting as much as they want and as much as they are capable of. So in the real world, eventually you've got to stop them. You've got to find a way to stop them, to a point where everybody says, okay, we surrender, something like that. That is the sort of path down which you want to go. So that is a sort of a high-level view of warfare. But when you are actually fighting, and you are actually busy fighting the enemy day by day, making your moves, doing your stuff, how are you going to measure or know that you are actually winning? How are you going to measure that you are going to get a real result? Suppose, for example, you're fighting and fighting, and then someone says, "Let's have a ceasefire." You know, all the old peaceniks come in. "Oh, we need a ceasefire. We need peace. We need peace at any price," or something like that. "Well, let's just have some peace for a day or a week or a month." How does that impact the war? Because the old peaceniks will come and they'll say, no, let's just stop for a week or a month and let's just call it a day and let everyone get a chance to have a rest and we'll figure things out. Is that a good thing? Is that something you want to do in a war if someone comes up with that? How can you tell whether you're winning? Are you going to look at the number of men who get killed every day? Are you going to look at how many kilometers your army is advancing every day? Are there signs that you'll be able to see that will show you that either you're winning or they're winning? What exactly is it that you're looking for? And that's really what I want to get to in this video, is the key critical measurement that is important to know. Because you need to have some kind of measurement that tells you whether you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. How do you know whether you are making progress or not? In modern times, like here in Africa, where we've fought lots of guerrilla wars, the viewpoint from the white side, let's call it our capitalist mindset viewpoint of warfare, was that the blacks would just never quit. The blacks are going to fight us until we give them something. And in our world, it became an issue that we are going to lose simply because we're never going to win. So just sit and think about that. And a similar thing happened in Vietnam with the Americans, that you are going to lose because your enemy will never give up. So what does that say about warfare? And then you would get people who would come in and they'd say, "Well, you see, you're doing it wrong. You are fighting these black people, you whites in South Africa, Rhodesia, you're fighting these black people and you're doing it wrong. You shouldn't be fighting them. You must go to them and talk to them so that they stop fighting you." And then they say that this war has got no political solution. It's got no political solution because we've done the wrong thing by fighting them, and that they will continue to fight us for as many decades or centuries as it takes in order to win. So we end up becoming demoralized because we can't beat them and they never surrender. So what have we done right or wrong? Now, that line of thinking that the wars have got no military solution, therefore the only thing is a political solution, That is very real thinking that went on in Southern Africa, but it was also across the Western world. The Western world would look at our situation and say, it's impossible for you to win. Therefore, you must deal with the blacks. You must go and talk to them. So all these kinds of thinking, what do these things tell us about the battle and the war and what we are doing? How do we know whether fighting is actually good in any way? Who's making the mistake? Are we making the mistake at a political level? Or are we making a mistake at a military level? What's going wrong? And so that is where I want to zoom in, because there's something that I want to show you so that you can understand what it is that we are really looking for. What are we really looking for? And what will we see that will indicate to us this is right or this is wrong? That's what we're going to be digging into. So let's start off with a video that comes from Papua New Guinea. This is Western Papua New Guinea. This is film footage of an actual tribal war among these silly low IQ people. And this was fought in modern times where white men were there with cameras to film it. We didn't have this ability in colonial times in the pre-1900 era. But blacks in Africa almost fought something like this. Almost. Very similar kind of concept. But here you'll be able to see it. So you're going to have two tribes, and the two tribes are fighting each other. And they have fought each other before. And now they're going to have yet another war. Such as it is. So they're going to have another war, and we're going to watch the whole war from the beginning to the end. And we're going to see, you know, being the dumb, retarded whites that we are, as the Jews claim, we're going to take a look at the high IQ, low IQ people to see what do they do. If the white man is so stupid, then what do these other goofballs get up to, okay? So you'll get a chance to see some kind of war, and you will see the rules of the war, and you'll see they've also got their generals, okay? They've got their generals and their commanders and their experienced people, and they also make decisions, and they carry on until eventually one side wins, okay? And that's what I want you to watch. And have a look at this. This is 12 minutes long. In 12 minutes, you'll get to see the whole war. And there are many things that happen in this war. Anyhow, check out this war, because I first want you to see what others do. And I want to take you through various things so that you first see the other side. How do they think? What do they do? And we will progress from there towards the white man's brilliance. So here's 12 minutes of war, the way the others do it. Oh, and before I forget, the goal is not to worry about the technology. The issue is not the low tech, because we've had low tech in our past as well. The issue is not the technology. It's not the low tech. The fact that they've got bows and arrows and so forth, that's not the issue. The issue is to watch their strategy and to watch what they are going for. What do they see as victory, and how do they go about getting victory? That's the real issue here. Whether you were fighting with knives or rocks or whatever, it doesn't matter. There is a specific thing that we are looking for that will indicate to us whether war is successful or not. But notice their thinking. Notice the scenario. Notice especially what they see as good or bad and as their means of winning. It's the strategy that's the issue. There are many other things that happen. You'll see all kinds of strange stuff. But anyway, check it out and try and look and see what you can make of these people in terms of what they are trying to achieve with their war, such as it is.
The whole ridge is for fighting, and both sides know it well. Wayak relaxes, waiting for his comrades and the enemy to signal their readiness by drawing close enough to fire. Only Mike Mo, who acts as leader, is especially concerned. The enemy badly wants the death that will restore the balance which they lost almost 3 weeks before. With so many men firing such a quantity of arrows, there is always a chance that one of the many wounds they are certain to inflict will bring about the death they want so much. Finally, Mike Mo's urgings take effect, and his men withdraw. It is customary that both sides, after fighting hard for a period of time, withdraw to nurse wounds, smoke cigarettes, and review the course of events. The arrows are not poisoned, but they are barbed and notched so as to break off on impact. One young warrior, pained but also pleased by his wound, was lucky that an older man has enough to hold as he works the arrow free. Wayak was worried that so many arrows had found their mark, but most of the others were merely stung into more aggressive action. The enemy fell back, thinking that Wayak's group had been secretly reinforced. Having retreated, there was nowhere for them to go except off the ridge and onto some flat land just in front of their little mountain. There, almost at their own frontier, they turned and resumed fighting. At the end of the ridge, the pursuers caught their breath. Close by the gardens, where their warrior had been killed during a raid only 3 weeks before, The enemy reorganized, knowing there was still time for fighting. As long as there is enough light to see arrows in flight, and barring sudden rain, or what is much rarer, sudden death, a formal battle continues throughout the day. Wayak rests and lets the younger men exert themselves on the skirmish line. In this, its new phase, the battle is supervised by Nilik, who sends a fresh group to back up the skirmishers. Past water-worn patches of white sand, a wounded enemy is carried home on the shoulders of his friends. Nilik, not yet convinced the enemy was content to end the fighting, keeps a watchful eye, as do two young warriors who, a moment before, sought in vain to kill each other. Laka and the others have come close to home. They are tired from the long walk and the heavy work, but glad to know that no one had been killed. Had it been otherwise, they would certainly have been told by someone along the trail, since such news goes with the speed of sound, shouted from garden to garden and village to village. Laka did hear that Tuesi, a man from Wuparainma, was badly wounded, and she wondered how he was. The arrow had ended beneath the collarbone, and its tip broke off beneath the skin. Tekman, because he lives with Tuesi in Wuparainma, and because he is famous as a surgeon, knew that the only way to get the arrow out was to grip it with his teeth. Had it been barbed, as most arrows are, Tuesi would have had a far more difficult time and much less chance of living. At the end of the ridge, the others hurl abusive jokes instead of spears. the enemy, for now, is forced to listen. To patch the wound, some moistened leaves are bound in place with bits of long grass. To revive his Atayaken, literally to call back his seeds of singing from their flight to his backbone, a friend applies a wand of grass and murmurs magic words. Tekman makes the last of four punctures in the belly's wall to let out the blood turned dark by the enemy's arrow. The time to leave has come. For most, the walk ahead will take an hour, and no one wants to risk a meeting with a ghost. Tuasi will not have to walk, but he must be covered to protect him from the gaze of ghosts, which wounded men are careful to avoid. Tuasi starts home, his weapons and his life in the hands of men from his own village.
So let me just make some comments about these people and their little war. This was in 1963, the year I was born in. And first let me make some general comments. That in this war, it was much more like a sport where they've got a place where they're going to meet to fight. In the real world, there are no such limitations. The less the enemy knows, the better. The more you can outwit the enemy, the better. So their form of warfare is much more like a sport, and it's got certain rules. So there are aspects of this that are more like a sport than a war. And their measurement of success for these tribes is to kill one guy. If after a whole day of fighting they can manage to kill one person, then they've won. Their weapons are pretty low-tech, but they use wooden arrows, and some of those arrows have got barbs on them. But they don't seem to have anything like spears, or if they do, they carry things that look like spears, but they don't fight with them. When I look at their weapons, just out of curiosity, I'd say if they had the most basic kind of shield, if they made the most basic kind of shield that blacks in Africa make, or they came up with the simplest kind of armor. I'm not talking about a metal thing. I'm talking about weaving things together, using wood and animal skins and so forth. If they had even the most basic kind of shield or armor, their arrows would not be able to hurt each other. So it's almost to me as if they don't even know about the concept of a shield. They do make a lot of noise, eh? And their whole style of warfare is very informal. and there's no particular tactics or coordination. It's literally one-on-one, and a couple of guys go and fight because they feel like fighting, and then a guy runs away and so on. It's very, very informal, and it goes on all day long. However, their general does have the ability to manage to get reinforcements to the front when the front is in danger of collapsing. But yeah, I would say that their style of warfare is several thousand years behind ours. Not just several hundred years behind ours, several thousand years behind us. Maybe 7 or 8 thousand years behind us. They are way, way behind. And our ancestors, even probably in the last several thousand years, had better medicine than them. I like the way they referred to the one guy as being an experienced surgeon, and he knows how to get the stuff out by gritting it with his teeth. I think you're giving him a lot more credit than he deserves. The arrow that broke off under the guy's collarbone, I found that quite a strange wound, but it must have hurt him somewhat. I was amazed by it. And one thing that amazed me about these wounds that they had was I don't see any blood. I'm amazed that there's no blood. I would have expected quite a bit of blood if you had a real injury. But anyway, maybe the fact that it punctured him under his collarbone and managed to get a little bit into his body, it hurt him a bit. I'm amazed that that was something that would be fatal. But yeah, I must tell you that the guy, the experienced surgeon who was busy puncturing his stomach, I reckon that the puncturing of his stomach was going to inflict more injury on the guy than the actual wound that he got there by his collarbone. I reckon that that experienced non-white surgeon was inflicting more injuries on him than the original injury. Really, that was crazy. And of course, in their advanced medical science, they have to be careful that injured men don't see ghosts. Anyhow, these people are totally retarded. And that whole thing of their medicine, oh, bring some grass. Put some grass on there and utter some magic words. Anyway, these people are totally retarded. They are completely and utterly way outside our level. They are way, way behind us. You're talking thousands and thousands of years behind us. You're talking prehistoric, okay? Long before we could write. Thousands of years before we even learned how to write. That's how far backward they are. However, regarding the warfare, mistakes that they were making, they were fighting in areas where they knew the enemy would be there. It was a prearranged thing. Another thing was they fight and fight and fight a lot, and then they stop and they have a break. By the way, did you notice? They also smoke cigarettes when they have a break. In all of these places, they've got all these European things that are already being used by them back in those days even. So cigarettes were available. I'll bet you that those cigarettes are European things. I doubt that they made cigarettes. Anyhow, the other thing that they did was they paused the fighting. Again, it's like a sport, and that's actually a bad thing. We'll discuss that a bit later. And just other comments. They are fighting face to face. There are no particular maneuvers. They're always coming at each other from the front. They're not engaging in even the slightest maneuvering around the side or trying to ambush someone or anything like that. So it's very much like a sport more than an actual war. But the key thing for them that allows them to determine victory is if they can injure someone on one of the two sides. If in the whole day of fighting, they can manage to get one guy killed. If they can get one guy to be killed or badly injured, then they've won. That's their victory. So their victory, again, is like a sport. It's determined by rules. It's not actually the way that war is fought in the real world. And I can tell you that you are talking people that are prehistoric, and the same is true for the blacks of Africa. You're dealing with prehistoric people, people who could never read or write. They have no clue. They don't have 1/10,000th or 100,000th of the kind of knowledge that we have. Even those numbers that I've given you are overestimates. These people are way behind us. So let's continue with a look at people who are apparently our equals, but in reality, they're nowhere close to us. In this case, modern South Africa. In this case, a very short video. It's from the time a few weeks back when Donald Trump had President Ramaphosa in the White House, and Trump was confronting them over kill the Boer, kill the farmer. And the thing that's of interest here is listen to Ramaphosa after the White House meeting. The video is only 3 minutes long. Listen to Ramaphosa discuss how South Africa functions, how the South African government functions nowadays. Listen to him discussing how things are done at a governmental level. It's very short, and you'll hear him say a bunch of stuff. Because the way that you function at a high level also is an absolutely critical thing during warfare. And you'll hear him saying, oh, well, you see, we're so civilized and we do it this way and this is our method. So I want you to hear that because we'll be talking again. You'll see how all these things tie up with warfare. So here's the video.
For us. And when it comes to the issues of arresting anyone for any slogan, that is a sovereign issue. It's not a matter where we need to be instructed by anyone that go and arrest this one. We are a very proud sovereign country that has its own laws, that has its own processes, and we take into account what the Constitutional Court also decided when it said that, you know, that slogan, kill the Boer, kill the farmer, is a liberation chant and slogan. And it's not meant to be a message that elicits or calls upon anyone to go and be killed. And that is what our court decided. So they will probably want to arrest people willy-nilly. We follow the dictates of our constitution. Because we are a constitutional state and we are a country where freedom of expression is the bedrock of our constitutional arrangements. Many people believe that we went to Washington to discuss Stalin. That is not so. The issue of Stalin never even came up in the discussions that we had in the White House with President Trump. Notwithstanding the fact that Elon Musk was there as part of the U.S. delegation. So it wasn't discussed. The process of having low-orbit satellites providing Wi-Fi and internet connectivity is known in South Africa. We've been through that. And there are quite a number of other companies, Chinese companies, European companies, and Russian companies, and many others, and local companies who are interested in getting into that space. So people tend to focus on one company only, and yet we've got a plethora of companies that would want to get into this space. So the environment to enhance or enable investment to happen in that space is precisely what needs to be properly crafted, properly permitted to enable that to happen. So the process that the minister has unleashed is a process that is going to elicit a lot of comment from the public, from various key stakeholders, including current role players in the sector. So that in itself is going to exhibit the true democratic process in our country, that when something new, something that is topical or even desirable has to be flighted or implemented or initiated, it's got to be supported by a lot of discussion.
So there's the Black Jew Ramaphosa who rules us. And the main thing I wanted you to hear was his discussion about processes. That, in this country, South Africa, we follow these processes. We have our processes. And we are following processes regarding these low orbit satellites. And it has to be properly crafted. And we've got processes that have been set in place by the minister. And it includes getting comments from the public. And it includes dealing with current role players. Now, while none of this is directly related to warfare, this is the kind of junk thinking that is highly prevalent everywhere in the world. And even in European countries, you'll see that people think in terms of the fact that you need to have everybody in on the high-level thinking of whatever it is that you're doing. But I just wanted to highlight that because in warfare, you don't have time for things like that. In warfare, to be effective, you need to be fast. And I have mentioned before the power of one. I'll be revisiting that in the future. But you need to be aware that when it comes to warfare, it has been shown time and again in European history that you need someone who knows what they're doing and they're fast and they can make up their minds quickly. They will get the information they need, make up their minds and move on. This is especially useful in actual combat. So this kind of slow poke, kind of dumbass way, let's call it the slow poke, low IQ, New South Africa, dumbass way of doing things. This kind of junk way of doing things at a high level is actually very bad. When you are involved in conflict, you need to really jack up your game. But I thought I'd just throw that in to show you the kind of lackadaisical conceptions that are quite common and that people think that this is the proper way, that's the best way. No, it's not. High-level thinking can move at a very high speed if you've got high IQ people. You can move around and chop and change things very quickly. And even some European countries, I know that they've got all kinds of processes inside their system, and you've got this group that's against that group, and this lot can block that lot. All that kind of stuff is very, very bad. And for whites in the future, you need to think about speed and people doing things faster and people being able to make decisions quicker because that is how you really function. Speed is a critical part of winning at everything. And we whites, we used to function 100 times faster than this. We can get stuff done very quickly. But I thought I'd just show you some, let's call it a local jackass, just so that you can hear out of his silly mouth the kind of crap that he says. And that kind of thinking is totally standard for all of South Africa now. All of South Africa functions on that junk kind of thinking. That's not white thinking, that's not European thinking. It's just a bunch of jackass thinking, that's all. And leave them to do it, because it doesn't work. Now let's take a look at another short video. This one is also 3 minutes long. This is about one of the recent wars that took place in Libya in recent times. Two factions fighting. One faction backed by Europe, one faction backed by Russia. And during this fighting, something came up. A particular weapon started really showing something. And this was even before the Ukraine war. But listen to the descriptions about the weapon and listen to them comparing the effectiveness of this weapon to things that had happened before.
The war in Libya has taken a dramatic turn as rival air forces, newly reinforced by allies overseas, duel over its skies. Because of the country's flat terrain, air power has been decisive in changing the fortunes of each side in turn, in particular with the use of armed drones. The warlord Khalifa Haftar's forces first used Chinese-made Wing Lung 2 armed drones 4 years ago, first in Derna and then to pressurize the UN-recognized Government of National Accord, or GNA, forcing it to retreat to a tight pocket round the capital, Tripoli. With a range of 1,500 kilometers, these have been able to operate out of bases in the east, striking government targets in the west. Heavily armed and able to loiter over targets, feeding back vital information to their headquarters, the Wing Lungs helped forces loyal to Khalifa Haftar advance and besiege the beleaguered GNA in Tripoli, often inflicting indiscriminate damage. But Turkey's extensive military aid to the UN-backed government earlier this year changed all that, as the GNA started to receive Turkish armed drones, namely the Bayraktar TB2. These drones, with their limited range, while not as capable as the Wing Lungs, still gave the GNA the ability to strike Haftar's forces, interrupt his supply lines, and protect its own units as they advanced, catching their enemies by surprise as Tripoli's troops counterattacked. In recent days, government forces have rapidly retaken several coastal towns and the all-important airbase at Al-Watir, which was retaken after several assaults and the destruction of the Russian-made Panzer air defense units in the area.
It's just been a huge kind of rush of blood to the head, really, for Haftar. I mean, you know, he's lost, effectively, in the last maybe 6 or 7 days, he's lost what almost took him 6 years to achieve. So that's, you know, it's no small feat what Turkish air assistance has given the GNA on the ground in terms of territory.
Haftar's forces have been driven back and their stranglehold in Tripoli has loosened. But in an ominous turn, the US military has confirmed Russian jets have flown from Russia's base in Syria to Jufra Air Base in Libya, a Haftar center of air operations. Satellite images issued by US Command in Africa clearly show Russian fighter aircraft on the runway. The influx of foreign aircraft into the Libyan conflict has changed the military balance for both sides. But momentum is now with forces loyal to the internationally recognized government in Tripoli, whose success has come with the extensive help of Turkey's government, as its forces take back control of most of western Libya. Alex Katopoulos, Al Jazeera.
Okay, in this video, you are now hearing some words and terms that you may not have taken note of before. In this case, they're talking about these rival air forces in this desert kind of a warfare, and they use the word decisive, and they are saying that air power is decisive in this war because the terrain is flat, etc., etc. And that is one of the words that is of tremendous interest in warfare, is you start thinking about something that is decisive. You want something that is decisive. And in this case, they go on to talk about various types of drones, Chinese versus Turkish drones. But then the guy says something really interesting. He says that the one side is advancing now and they're starting to capture towns that they hadn't captured before. And the most critical thing that he said in there was that in the last 6 to 7 days, the one side was losing what it had taken them 6 years to have. So the guy points out that one of the sides has lost in a week, in 1 week, he's lost what took him 6 years to achieve in 1 week. And they attribute it to air power. Don't concern yourself too much with all the kinds of weapons and whether this weapon is better than that weapon whether you have to have this weapon in order to achieve something else. These things chop and change according to other more complex things that relate to the conflict. All conflicts are not the same. If you are fighting first world conflicts, in other words, let's call it high civilization conflicts, then you do need certain things because your opponents will have certain sophisticated things. But as you move down into third world type of stuff, like the kind of stuff we have, the situation can change a hell of a lot because it depends which side has got access to what the technology on the ground is, and many other things. So there are lots of things that may appear to be carved in stone, but not necessarily so. Warfare is very complex, and it depends on a big mixture of many things. Unquestionably, drones are a big player, but there are other ratios that also come into play. In World War II, with the Germans focusing on the tanks, the panzers, it wasn't just tanks alone that did everything. There were other weapons along with the tanks. And there's a big mixture of weapons that work together. And there are times when one weapon runs into problems. There is a video that I did about the biggest tank battle of World War II that you've never heard of. And in that one, you see what happens when the Germans run into weaponry that is too powerful for their armor to handle. So when they run into the really strong, really huge Russian weapons, how their army then had to change in order to fight that. But the Germans were so flexible that their troops could do it on the ground without much hassle. So you must never see warfare as being carved in stone, that certain things always win every single day. There are times when things can go very wrong, even for your prime weapon. And there are lots of mixtures of subtle things that all come into play in warfare. Warfare is extremely complex, and it's also very dynamic. But anyway, the bottom line was that in this particular case, one side had drones and they were able to achieve in 1 week what had taken the other side 6 years to achieve. That one side had been fighting for 6 years to gain ground, and that side then lost 6 years worth of fighting, was undone in 1 week. So things can move extremely fast on the battlefield. Even after long periods of time, if certain things change, then suddenly things can start moving really, really fast. And in European warfare, the fate of entire nations has been decided in the past in time periods as little as 1 hour or 2 hours. Literally 1 hour of fighting changes the fate of Europe. 1 hour of fighting in a particular battle determines the fate of Europe for the next 50 years. Warfare can change the balance of things very, very quickly. But the key term that you heard in this video was decisive. Decisive. That in this particular case, it was a weapon that was decisive. But you are looking for things that lead to decisive results. And when you've got decisive results, that's when things start moving really fast. When somehow you've managed to get the mixture right so that you can win really, really fast. The next short video is 5 minutes long, and it's from this year, 2025. And you're going to hear a British military professor talking about how come the Syrian war went so fast and the one side collapsed so quickly. So here's the video.
I wonder your thoughts. How did this rebel advance develop so quickly?
Well, Leah, I mean, from a military point of view, it's not that surprising because it is what tends to happen. I mean, if you look at what happened in Libya in 2011, in the civil war there, the civil war went all the way from Tripoli in the east, right through from Benghazi in the east, all the way to Tripoli in the west, and then all the way back from Tripoli to Benghazi again, across the whole North African coast. And the same happened in 2014 when ISIS attacked in Syria, northern Syria and Iraq, and they were at the gates of Baghdad within weeks. Because what tends to happen is that we're not dealing with densely populated areas here. So when one city falls or surrenders, the defenders fall back to the next city, which might be 40 or 50 miles away, and everybody just gets into their trucks and goes to the next city. So big areas get covered in these sorts of countries when there is an advance. And in this case, I've been struck by the fact that over the last days, very little fighting has taken place. The Russians have launched ferocious air attacks until a couple of days ago, which didn't stem the advance. And actually, the Syrian army didn't fight at all. And so, you know, officers were leaving their units. And if their officer leaves the unit, then the unit just collapses. Why should people fight if the officers clear off? And there are lots of reports of officers, you know, getting out of their uniforms, going into civilian clothes, just fleeing. When that happens, an army is in a state of complete collapse. And when collapse starts in one place, it tends to gets known about, start somewhere else. So, I mean, what Assad was facing was encroachment on three fronts by three different groups. So he had HTS coming at him from the north. He had this group of this sort of ragbag group called the Southern Front coming at him in Deraa from the south. And he had the Kurdish group at Deir ez-Zor, right out in the east, taking that. So he was under pressure on three fronts from three different groups, and the Syrian army decided it wasn't going to fight, and so it didn't. So the groups, as they moved forward, were able to do deals, saying, look, just leave your weapons and go home. There won't be any retribution, just leave. And that's what rank and file tend to do.
Yeah, what's so interesting, though, isn't it, with the help of Russia and Iran, Assad has been able to crush any opposition and survive. So why then is this rebel advance? Why now? Why has it been possible now, Michael?
Yeah, because the Russians and the Iranians were both engaged in very low-cost operations. So the Russians were providing air power, but not many boots on the ground in Syria, apart from the Wagner Group, who, of course, were effectively expelled with the Prigozhin coup in Russia in 2023. And the Iranians work through the Republican Guard, which are this, you know, the Quds force, the militias, they're quite well trained, but there are only small groups of them. So neither Russia nor Iran really committed much to Syria, because backing up a ruthless dictatorship, which literally had, you know, I mean, the Syrian civil war has killed almost 600,000 people, and almost 400,000 of them are civilians. And of those 400,000 civilians, 90% of them were killed, murdered by the Assad regime. So backing up such a murderous regime, in a sense, was quite cheap, because all you had to do was provide thugs on the ground. When that regime comes under any sort of sustained pressure, and this was pressure on three sides in three different places, suddenly that limited commitment that Russia and Iran was making wasn't enough. And so either they were going to commit much more, or they were going to have to pull out. And both of them decided that they would throw Syria under the bus and pull out.
We've seen pictures this morning, Michael, of people celebrating in Damascus, chanting freedom. Many happy then, Assad is gone. What next?
Well, it would be nice to think that there might be some sort of a multi-party group that might form. And the Prime Minister, Jalali, has said, I will carry on. I mean, he was working for Assad, and he said, I will be in my office, I will carry on, and I will work with anybody. And HTS, the main group, and Jalali, the leader of the group, has said, we will form some sort of national front. But we'll see. I mean, the brutal truth, Leah, is that if you look across the Middle East, all Middle Eastern countries seem to require relatively autocratic governments. And Israel, of course, always says we are the only democracy in the Middle East. And there's some truth to that, even though the democracy in Israel has been under enormous strain in the last few years. But I mean, look in the Gulf, what you've got are kingdoms ruling with a sort of benevolent dictatorship, but they've got lots of money, they've got cash, so they can buy off a lot of protests. In the Levant itself, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Egypt, Iraq, you've got very strong either one man or one party governments, and right through to North Africa, the same. The nearest we have had to a multi-party government in an Arab state was in Tunisia. after the Arab Spring, and that collapse, it just didn't go anywhere.
So if you listen to Professor Michael Clark in Britain, he was mentioning the fact that the fighting in those parts of the world is fighting that is in areas that are not densely populated, and that low density means that the people can move longer distances. There's nobody getting in their way, and they literally just get into their vehicles and they drive to the next town and they go and fight there. But he pointed out that in Syria, there were big advances taking place, but there was very little fighting. And then he went on to describe how officers in the Syrian army were leaving their own units, and that the officers in charge of the troops were getting out of their uniforms and changing into civilian clothing. And that once the officers start leaving the units, then the rank and file follow. And that he was saying that the army is in a state of collapse, and that those who were advancing were able to even say to the Syrian army, look, you don't have to fight us. If you just go home, all is forgotten, and that's it. And they were then able to just carry on advancing and doing their thing. So what you were seeing in Syria was a collapse of the army. The army is busy collapsing internally. And when the officers aren't even keen on fighting anymore, then everyone gives up. So that's a very, very important point. And now for the final video. The final video is a 4-minute video that relates to the time of Napoleon. But this is not Napoleon that's involved in this. This is even before Napoleon rose to power. After the French Revolution, there was a portion of France where there were whites who were against the French Revolution. They were basically royalists. And they started forming their own little army, and they actually ended up fighting a war against the new French government. And the war ran for a couple of years. But in December 1793, the French government sent a military force to fight them, and the end result was the Battle of Savenay. So I'm going to play a short video for you that is 4 minutes long, where a lady discusses this battle and this region in France and what happened. This little video has got nice maps, so it's good to just see the region of France that was basically challenging the government and the region where this fighting was taking place. Here's the video.
In the tumultuous backdrop of the French Revolution, the war in the Vendée erupted as a counter-revolutionary movement against the radical changes sweeping across France. The Battle of Savenay, waged on December 23, 1793, stands as a pivotal moment in this conflict, marking a decisive defeat for the royalist counter-revolutionaries and further solidifying the course of the French Revolution. The war in the Vendée was a complex and multifaceted conflict that emerged in response to the revolutionary policies of the National Convention. The predominantly Catholic and royalist population of the Vendée region resisted the radical secularization and anti-religious measures imposed by the revolutionary government in Paris. What began as a regional uprising soon escalated into a full-fledged armed conflict. The royalist forces, consisting of peasants, nobles, and clergy, united under the banner of counter-revolution. The Vendée rebels sought to defend their traditional way of life and resist the centralization of power by the revolutionary government. The conflict witnessed several military campaigns, with both sides engaging in a brutal and often indiscriminate struggle for control. As the conflict intensified, the National Convention, under the leadership of representatives like Jean-Baptiste Carrier, dispatched sizable military forces to quell the Vendée uprising. The Battle of Savenay was a culmination of a series of confrontations between the Republican forces and the Royalist insurgents. The stage was set for a decisive clash that would shape the outcome of the war. The Battle of Savenay witnessed notable figures on both sides. The Republican forces, under the command of generals like Louis-Marie Turreau, aimed to crush the Royalist resistance decisively. On the Royalist side, leaders such as Charles de Bonchamps and François Athanasie Charette sought to maintain the momentum of their cause. On December 23, 1793, the Battle of Savenay commenced. The Republican forces, possessing superior numbers and firepower, launched a coordinated assault against the Royalist positions. The battlefield, situated near the town of Savenay, became a theater of intense and bloody combat as both sides fought fiercely for their respective ideals. The Battle of Savenay resulted in a resounding victory for the Republican forces. The Royalist counter-revolutionaries faced significant losses, and their resistance in the Vade suffered a severe blow. The aftermath of the battle saw reprisals and harsh measures implemented by the Republican government to suppress any lingering resistance in the region. The Battle of Savenay had a profound impact on the war in the Vade. It marked a turning point in favor of the Republican forces, consolidating their control and quelling the Royalist insurgency. The defeat dealt a severe blow to the hopes of the Vade rebels and contributed to the eventual suppression of the counter-revolutionary movement. The Battle of Savenay left a lasting legacy in the history of the war in the Vade and the French Revolution. The conflict in the Vade, characterized by its complex social, religious, and political dimensions, remains a topic of historical reflection and debate. Memorials and commemorations in the Vade region serve as reminders of the sacrifices made and the profound impact of this tumultuous chapter in French history.
That was quite a nice short little video about that battle. Those kinds of things like the counter-revolution among the French is something that I know very little of myself. And I was quite impressed by that little video that even had more details on the maps of the areas where the people were fighting back against the revolution, and how nobles and common people and priests were all banding together against the French Revolution. But that battle was a battle where the counter-revolutionary forces stood no chance. They sent 18,000 troops to the area, and they were fighting about 6,000 people. And large numbers of those people were killed. So they were outnumbered about 3-1. And the French army lost very few people. They lost about 30 dead and 200 wounded, whereas the counter-revolutionaries, the royalists, lost between 4,000 to 6,000 dead. There were also civilians among them. So it was a real slaughter of whites that took place there. But the key issue in this little war that was going on in that corner of France is that this battle was the end of all resistance. This was a decisive battle, and this battle basically broke the back of the resistance of these people. So it was decisive, and that meant that it's pretty much game over. So I want to bring all these different things together to explain some stuff to you. But before I do that, I just had to show you yet another of my fun moments with images. On the screen in front of you, the image, decisive German victory, France 1940. I must say, this is really, really astounding. I am thoroughly enjoying these images. However, we've got serious work to do, so let's get on with the final stuff. So we're back to my normal collage, and my collage for today is Mars, the Roman god of war, on the left, and Napoleon on the right. You will later understand why he's a real god of war, Napoleon. Anyhow, let's sit back and look at the things that I've shown you, and then assess it to see what it is exactly that we are looking for. In warfare, you are looking for things that will hurt the enemy. You are looking for things that will kill their troops, harm them, weaken them, etc. And you are looking for all different methods that will harm them, weaken them, inflict losses and pain on them. However, in order to win war decisively and to win battles decisively, you have to inflict so much pain on the enemy that the enemy just cannot continue anymore. You need to inflict so much pain on them that no matter how much they hate you, no matter how much they want to resist you, that they just won't be able to continue anymore. That no amount of hatred, no amount of willpower, no amount of strength that they have will be enough for them to resist you. So you've got to give them pain and suffering to a point where they can't take it anymore. You've got to give them pain and suffering to an extent that is beyond that which they can handle. That is the first key element that you're looking for. You're looking for that in battles, in individual battles, and you're looking for that on a larger scale in the war itself. So in a particular battle, you want to grip them and you want to hurt them and you want to smash them and beat them down. And you want to make it so nasty and so difficult for them to deal with it that they just can't handle it. You need to overload them with pain, suffering, harm, terror, etc. You see, in warfare, it doesn't matter if someone hates you. It doesn't matter that they hate you to death. The point in warfare is that you're gonna break them to the point where it absolutely doesn't matter how they feel about you, how much hatred they have, they are going to quit because what you are doing to them is so devastating that they, as a group, cannot handle it anymore. That what is coming at them is so nasty, it's so horrible that they just want it to end. They just want it to stop because you are inflicting so much pain on them. That is the key thing to remember. It applies to battles and it applies to war as a whole. You want to hurt to the maximum that you can hurt them. They in their turn will be doing their utmost to hurt you. And so part of the game is also that you want to inflict more pain on them than they can inflict on you. And if they do hurt you, you want to be able to keep going so that you can really hit them with the punches that they can't handle. So that in a basic form is what you are looking at. But because you are dealing with groups, because you are dealing with a bigger structure, there is more to it than meets the eye. So I want to come back and talk about that in more depth and tie it all together. But the simplest way to compare it is to take a sport like boxing. Boxing is probably the best sport that gives you an idea of what you are really looking for. Because boxing has got its rules, but boxing does have one option that other sports don't have. And boxing can result in a knockout blow. In boxing, you can knock your opponent out and your opponent will no longer have the ability to resist you. When you connect him in the correct way, it doesn't matter how big he is, how strong he is. He's going down. And even if he tries to get up, he's really not going to be in the kind of shape that he's going to be able to resist you much. He can try, but he has already been weakened and it's going to be easier than ever to really clobber him. So boxing is the closest sport that exists that gives you an idea of how you want to inflict a massive injury on the other side. Because boxing is something straightforward to understand and you can see the results instantly. Boxing and a knockout blow is like a decisive victory. You can fight him for however many rounds, but boy, when you get that punch right and you connect him, he's going down to the floor. He is going down, and size doesn't matter. His willpower to come back won't matter anymore, because the pain that you inflicted on his physical body is struggling to recover from it. So it doesn't matter if he's got all the willpower in the world. If you knocked him solidly, he's down, and he can try and crawl back up, but he's in bad shape, you're in good shape, and you'll be able to finish him off if he even has the balls to try again. So the best comparison is boxing. So let me give you a little bit of entertainment. 9 minutes of film footage about a white guy who was on his way to becoming a world champion boxer, but things went wrong for him. I'm not sure if people were working against him or whether it has to do with his lifestyle, because he liked to party. But nevertheless, he was an awesome guy. And this white guy had a punch that was unreal. And this guy was incredible. This is in more modern times. There were also super kick-ass white boxers in past decades. But this is a much more recent guy. His name is Tommy Morrison. His life doesn't end so well, but if you check out Tommy Morrison, you'll get an idea. Here's a white man with a serious punch. And what Tommy Morrison is doing to his opponents, that's what an army needs to do to its opposition. Needs to connect them and take them down. But we'll discuss the detail of groups, of organizations, and the connecting and smashing of an organization after this. So here's some 9-minute awesome footage of Tommy Morrison, born in the American South and a really tough boy.
Being an alleged distant relative of the movie star John Wayne, he took the ancestor's moniker, the Duke, and in November 1988, went on a journey to conquer the professional ring. The 6 foot 2 inch tall kid with a frame north of 200 pounds was menacing enough, but what stuck out the most was his patented left hook. None of the initial 5 opponents could survive the first 3 minutes. It wasn't until the 6th performance, dated February 1989, that the Duke encountered a semblance of competition. In the beginning of the fight against Traore Ali, Tommy ate a few straights from long range.
Sir, he's got that square shoulder.
In response, he turned to the trademark hook. Thunderous naked right hands aggravated the situation. Traore wasn't going anywhere and bravely withstood the onslaught for 3 rounds. Nevertheless, at the 9-minute mark, he lingered in the line of fire for too long.
There it is. Come on, punch. That's it. That's what I'm talking about.
Whoa! A delayed reaction on that.
In the 4th frame, another clinch decided the outcome of the meeting.
A finisher. Yep. Good right uppercut.
All right. That'll be the winner. Ali.
That evening, the right uppercut became the weapon of choice and knocked down the vis-a-vis twice for a TKO.
Yep. Good right uppercut.
The canonical puncher style, always aiming to send the rival to the hospital, did not disappoint in further collisions. Morrison invariably broke into close quarters and unloaded thumping hooks and uppercuts. Come summer, he had stacked up a pile of 11 unconscious bodies.
Oh,
Anderson delights his hometown Kansas City fans with a two-round...
Signing with Bill Caton, a famous manager responsible for Mike Tyson's rise, helped the Duke's ascension towards the elite. With a team full of professionals in the corner, the surging prospect went on a title conquest. Justifying the flattering comparisons with Iron Mike.
Morrison and liked it because of the left hook.
In August of 89, Morrison viciously punished the torso for 3 minutes, hoping to crush Mike Robinson in spectacular fashion.
And gets maximum power into that.
Punishing body shots by Morrison. Robinson.
The first knockdown materialized in the dying seconds of the round.
Morrison just doing a great job of the body, and Robinson goes down. And before
unable to score a body shot KO in the opening stretch,
Robinson somehow
Tommy completed the job in the second.
Big left hand, and Robinson's in trouble again. I think we'll see. Huge body shot, and down goes Robinson. Steve Smoker wide.
The next bout, 2 weeks later, followed the same time schedule.
Morrison working over. Ropes here and getting the best of it. Right, incidentally, as an amateur, he lost the Olympic trials. A big right hand followed up on the left by Morrison and Shelby.
In September, Rick Ennis, with 15 knockouts and 18 victories, vowed to stay away from the bludgeoning hooks. And yet, that was too hard of a task.
Legs back under it now, but he was really rocking the left hand.
Dave Jacko, an owner of 21 wins and 18 finishes, tried to keep the distance in the kickoff. Tommy threw a couple of light jabs and made the opponent taste his mighty punch.
I have to face a right-hander.
There's a left-hand, Jacko's down and probably out.
A leaping left hook became a perfect storm, turning Jacko's grit off with one touch. The Duke's name started coming up in the title conversation.
In the first round,
Tommy the Duke Morrison comes to boxing naturally. He's related to John Wayne, whose real name was Marion Morrison. He's grooming Tommy for a shot at heavyweight champion Mike Tyson, and it could be the grudge match of the century.
Confirming expectations, Morrison made short work of the experienced Harry Terrell.
On his right hand, and he lands a left. He has his opponent protecting himself from trying to against the ropes.
Forcing the referee to initiate the count in the second minute with a clubbing left. Tommy stamped an exclamation mark with a long overhand.
227 pounds. Here, right stop this fight. He has got to his feet, but he stopped the fight. Another first round knockout.
Terrell courageously endured the knockdown, but soon was left dangling on the ropes like a puppet with cut strings.
27 pounds. Here,
in a span of 11 months as a pro, the 20-year-old had 18 victorious performances, 16 of which ended in stunning annihilations. The Duke was proclaimed the great white hope of boxing. Simultaneously, Tommy's charming charisma and debilitating power brought him more than just athletic acclaim.
227 pounds.
A series of killer finishes attracted unexpected attention outside the ropes. Most impressed with Morrison's abilities was Sylvester Stallone, who invited him to play Tommy Gunn in the upcoming Rocky V. During pre-production, the Duke fought two times to promote the movie. For one of the contests, he walked out wearing famous shorts from the franchise, and Stallone himself was in the corner.
Tommy, the Duke Morrison!
It was not difficult for Tommy to reproduce his signature style on the big screen. An abundance of left hooks and shattering right hands for the viewer's liking. The heavy hitter and baby mama magnet woke up as a star in an ocean full of gorgeous women.
Can you put an estimate on the number of women?
I'd easily say one a day. You know, that's that he never knew.
But I'm hungry, like you were. All I'm asking for is a chance. And just one shot.
After being on the set and resting for half a year combined, the freshly minted Tommy Gunn returned in June of 1990.
Ouch!
Nonetheless, having broken his hand in a tune-up bout, Morrison spent 4 months on the bench. In the second comeback, the previous injury did not prevent him from adding another disintegration to the portfolio.
He does have a devastating left cut.
Well, that's it.
A month later, versus Mike Acey, the Duke scored an elegant knockdown with a right cross.
We'll see.
Down to one knee from a right hand.
A picture-perfect left hook closed the show.
Laid down. He's landing. Oh, that should be it.
That was a left hand.
In 1991, Tommy Gunn continued to gain momentum. The crazy fighting schedule paid off, and in a span of 6 months, he collected 4 vicious stoppages.
Walk in and throw that hook, and he does have a devastating left hook.
Well, that's it.
Some of the victims were high-ish caliber heavyweights. Former WBC champion Pinklin Thomas survived a full round of shelling.
Some big falls, and there's that wicked punch.
But a cut saved him from coming out for the second.
He goes to his corner, and this is...
The first man to go the distance with Tyson, James Tillis, could not withstand Morrison's pressure either, falling with every touch by the left hand.
Still trying to really to get himself back in, but good left hand, down goes Tillis. And a good combination again by Morrison, a left and a right behind him, left for cut, down goes...
Having been knocked down twice, Tillis met his own demise on the ropes.
Wondering if Tillis is...
Well, there it is,
that's it.
Thus, in 2.5 years, the Duke removed 28 antagonists out of the way, and only 4 of them did not need a head scan when things were settled. Tommy surpassed many world champions in popularity and became a contender for the belt.
Morrison! A lot of people are pretty satisfied with saying, hey, you know, I fought for the heavyweight championship of the world. We don't want to fight for it. We want to fight for it and win it.
So how was that Tommy Morrison stuff, hey? And lots of his opponents needed to go for a head scan afterwards. He was popping them left, right, and center. But in that film footage, did you see how many guys were hit where guys are still trying to stand up and so forth? Doesn't matter if they're trying to stand up and maintain their balance, etc. When you are hit hard enough, you're going down. You're starting to lose control of your body. Your physical body cannot take it anymore. Whether it's due to concussion, whether it's due to whatever else was hit, you are going down. So by that point, it doesn't matter how much willpower and determination the guy has. He got smacked 6 ways to Sunday. He's going down. And that's the basic principle of warfare. They can hate you with every ounce of their being, but your goal is to bring their resistance to an end. Now, in the case of individuals, like in boxing or in combat, if you can kill someone or injure someone, then he's out of the game, either permanently or temporarily. But what about an organization? What about an organization? An army is an organization, and an army has got units, and those units are also organizations. You're going to have platoons, you're going to have companies, you're going to have battalions, you're going to have brigades, armies, etc. So the entire army is composed of lots of units, from small units to big units, and all of these units have got structures, they've got leaders, they've got people in different positions. And so you are not just looking at destroying one guy. You need to do something more significant, that has meaning. And in warfare, your goal is to inflict as much pain and damage on those units as you possibly can. And when you do, if you do it right, there comes a time where a unit will start to break down. So if your smallest unit is, let's say, a platoon, and it's got 30 guys in it, that platoon can fight for a period of time and can take a certain amount of pain and beatings. You can kill a couple of guys in the platoon, and the platoon will still be functioning. and the platoon will still be fighting back. The platoon will still be giving you hell. But as you kill and injure more and more guys, the platoon starts behaving like those boxers. As more guys get killed and injured, then the guys who are left who are alive start suffering from, let's call it, the after effects of what's happening to all of them. So even though there are troops still around, and maybe still their commanding officers still around, and most of them are still around, the fact is they start suffering from various forms of shock and fear and depression as they notice their comrades either being killed or injured, and as they feel the intensity of the fighting, they themselves start becoming afraid. They start feeling the pressure and the overload. And then they will begin wondering, are they going to be killed? Are they going to be killed? Can they survive this attack, etc.? So as you inflict death and injury on a unit, the unit itself starts becoming unstable. And it may also depend who gets killed. If their commanding officer happens to get killed quite early on in the fight, that may make it quite a mess for them. The second in charge guy will immediately take over and issue his orders, but it could be a big morale drainer for the rest of the group. So as you hurt a group of men and you inflict pain on the group as a whole, you don't have to kill everybody in order to win. Long before you get to the point where you kill everyone, long before then, the group itself will start breaking apart. It just depends how good their morale is, how strong their minds are, but sooner or later, when the damage done to the unit reaches a certain point, you're going to get guys that are going to want to leave, or you're going to get guys who want to surrender. Some may run, some may surrender, but they will feel the pain. Now, it also depends on some of the other factors, because not only might they be suffering from pain and injury at the current time, but maybe it is part of other things that have happened quickly, that things have happened so fast, that other bigger things may have happened so fast that also caught them off guard. Maybe one day they were sitting quite quietly at their posts, and the next thing they know is they're being attacked from the side. They've got people doing this, enemies coming down on them, but it's coming at them from multiple angles, and they are feeling the strain, okay? All kinds of weird things are happening. It's happening fast. Guys are dropping dead, and all sorts of nasty things are happening, and it's happening fast and unexpectedly. And that too will add to the pain and the freak out. Now, this can happen to a small unit, but as you get bigger organizations, bigger forms of organizations, like let's say a battalion, let's say 600 men or something like that, a battalion can fight on for a period of time. It can take a certain amount of pain. It can dish out lots of pain of its own. But it too will have a breaking time. There will come a time where those 600 guys will quit, where they won't be able to take it anymore. And as you go up through the structures to the level of a division with, say, 10,000 troops, a division is a serious, big fighting unit, got a lot of punch that it can pack. But even that division, put under enough strain, that division's going to start breaking. Certain units are going to take very high losses. And there will be units that might take low losses. But because of the situation of the division as a whole, they may become so demoralized when they see their buddies dead, other units running, this thing happening, that despite it being a big organization of 10,000 men, they will start flipping out. They will start wanting to retreat, wanting to give up, because the division can only take so much pain. And the same happens to an army. The army can fight on a big front, can fight a whole bunch of enemy, but there comes a point where the army's structure starts breaking down, where the commanders start feeling there's no hope, when the ordinary soldiers start feeling there's no hope. The role of leadership in all these situations, the role of the leadership is to constantly keep the rank and file focused on doing what they need to do. In all human structures, the leaders are there to keep pushing the rank and file forward, to keep on giving the rank and file hope and leadership and reason to believe that they must continue the fight. That's how all human structures work. And the leadership is running around trying to hold things together. But there will come a time where even the leadership starts losing faith in themselves, and where higher leadership may have to come and tell them, hey, don't quit, there is hope, etc. When you've got groups of humans fighting together and working together as a team, they may feel a certain amount of confidence in their numbers and in their strength. But when they feel certain amounts of pain and they see certain signs, then they can become depressed and despondent and downright straight afraid. And later it doesn't matter. Later it won't matter how much they hate you. It won't matter what they think of you. Their fear and their despondency will take control of them. That no matter how brave they are, when they see people dying around them and guys being shot up and blown to pieces, that eventually it becomes too much for them. But in bigger structures like armies and divisions and so forth, there are going to be lots of troops that are unaffected. There are going to be some units that take hardly any losses. However, they will be impacted negatively when they see chunks of the army quitting and running away, surrendering. This group surrendered. That leader was killed. When that bad news comes in and they start understanding their situation, or they see the determination of the enemy and the firepower of the enemy, they won't even care. They won't even care how much they hate you. If your firepower is enough, their hatred will melt away and they will run for their lives. So if you think back to some of these videos that I've shown you, those low IQ people in Guinea, they were just trying to kill one guy in a day, and their win was just symbolic. That would never have worked in the real world. In the real world, it's much more brutal, it's much more rough. And in the real world, there also are no rules. You can attack in any way you want, you can attack them from behind, and your goal is to cause mayhem. Your goal isn't to go and kill one guy. Your goal is to cause real mayhem. And if you can work out a set of tactics, this group attacks from the left side, the other group attacks from the right side, this is how we're going to do this thing. All of that cumulatively is what starts affecting the other side. And in warfare, you aren't concerned about who hates you and this and that. All that matters is your physical ability to inflict pain, suffering, and fear on them to such a degree that small units start breaking up. And when the small units start breaking up, bigger units will start breaking up. And so it carries on. You are dealing with a human structure. Now, if you want to win the war, you've got to break the whole structure. You've got to break the structure of the country. So you've not just got to fight the army, but you ultimately want all resistance to collapse. Though destroying the army will be 99% of the job. Once you've destroyed the army, then the rest will follow very quickly. It'll be a quick roundup. But you are looking at lots of humans, huge numbers of humans, working together as a team. And if you inflict light losses on them, and you are expecting the light losses to break them, you're wrong. It's never going to happen that way. Inflicting some casualties on them will cause them to hate you, but it will not cause them fear. It will not cause them to run away. So if you inflict some casualties today, yeah, it gives them some pain. If you inflict some casualties on them tomorrow, next week, next month, all of it will cause them to be even more determined than before. Although that's not always the case, eh? Inflicting pain on people will cause them to think about what they are doing. And while some will become stronger and will hate you more, there are many that will take note of the pain that has been inflicted, and they themselves will wonder if they should be fighting you. But as long as the pain isn't great enough, then they won't act on it. Ultimately, to break a human structure, you need to inflict massive pain on it. When you are dealing with an enemy nation and an enemy army, as long as you only inflict a limited amount of pain, there are conditions under which they can even get used to it. If you kill a certain number every day and their structures are still able to hold together, let's say you kill 50 a day out of a division or army or whatever, then they can actually get used to it. They could get used to it and it becomes the norm, and after a time they won't even worry about it. They'll get so used to it and they'll get used to seeing death and it won't bother them. But as you ratchet things up and you kill 50 and 100 and 150 and 200 and then it's 500 in a day, then it starts impacting them. And ultimately it is a combination not just of logic, but also raw fear. Nature wants you to live, and they themselves will experience fear, raw fear. And raw fear is a very powerful force. Raw fear is something that can make them just do the crazy shit and just run away. And if you look at all wars, you'll see that it's the same old thing, that if you want to win, you need to inflict pain, and you need to inflict heavy pain. But if you do it slowly over a long period of time, that's the wrong thing to do. Because when you leave things for a time, people adjust. People are very adaptable. Humans are very adaptable. If you subject humans to pain and suffering over a long period of time, then they actually get used to it. All humans get used to things. I can tell you that from here in Southern Africa, you can get used to anything. You can get used to all kinds of weird and ugly things, given enough time. If you are given enough time to adjust, you can get used to almost anything, as long as it doesn't inflict too much pain on you personally. But you can get used to a hell of a lot of stuff. And people who live in conflicts and in violent cities and so forth, with time, you will adjust and get used to it. There are things that many of you might think you won't be able to get used to it, but I assure you, you will. The human mind is a very powerful tool, and the human mind adapts in more ways than you can imagine. And when you are busy with something that is unpleasant, but it carries on over a long time, you'll be amazed how used to it you will get. Those of you who don't think you'll be able to handle some of the wildness that is coming to your countries, you'd be surprised. You'll be able to handle all kinds of things. And the key to it is if it's introduced to you slowly. If pain and suffering comes at you slowly, you will adapt. And you'll be amazed, you'll be absolutely amazed how much you can adapt. And when you've got a group of people and you're talking to each other and people are interacting with each other, you'll be amazed how the group can adapt to all kinds of things. So in warfare, you want to inflict pain and suffering, but you want to inflict it on them as fast as possible and as intensely as possible. because that is what makes people break down. And the faster you can make life unpleasant for them, the sooner they won't be able to handle it. But if you do it slowly over a long period of time, they'll get used to it. The human mind is so flipping adaptable. And the human mind analyzes situations and gets used to them. It gets very used to them. So if you look at wars like our own wars in Africa, where we inflicted bits of pain on the blacks over a long period of time, that's totally wrong. That is totally wrong. And that is why in that New Guinea war, when they broke for a rest, that's wrong, because you don't want to give the other side a rest. If you give them a rest, then they get a chance to sit down, calm down, recharge their batteries, literally. They get some time for their minds to sit and get used to things. And by allowing them to rest, they will be ready for round two. You know, that's why in boxing, you have got rounds with rest periods in between. That allows you to gather your senses about you, to relax, to get your mind in order again. In warfare, you don't want to do that. In warfare, you don't want to do that. You want them under stress, and you want to keep them under stress. And the stress must never go away. And if possible, you want to ratchet up the stress as much as you can. And when things are unexpected, it shocks people. And things that are unexpected, nasty, sudden, and it's news of a kind they've never heard before, all of those things shock the human psyche. And if you can shock the human psyche suddenly and quickly and in a big way, then the human psyche can be caught off guard and fear can start kicking in. Fear can start kicking in and fear can do nasty things. And that's what you're looking for. You're looking for the raw stuff. You need to get people into a situation of raw, abject fear. Fear that drives them crazy. When they are scared enough, then nobody will be able to stop them. They'll just run off and surrender or do something unexpected. You want to get them into a situation that is as unpleasant as possible, as quickly as possible. Grown men run. Grown men break and run en masse when they are under enormous pressure. The human mind focuses on the need to survive, and it's a fight or flight response. So when the mind perceives that death is coming or that death is inevitable, then people will start breaking down. You will get those soldiers and officers who are only going to be stopped by a bullet or a shell. You're going to have to kill the guy or injure the guy in order to stop him. But there are many that aren't like that at all. And if they see that their side is losing and that death is almost a certainty, then they will call it a day. Now, there are differences as well between us and other races. And the lower IQ races aren't as tough mentally as we are. But it is very important that we ensure that our minds are much tougher, because a lot of the time, the strength of your mind and your ability to handle nasty things is the key to keeping your morale up and keeping you going. Whereas lower IQ types can be overwhelmed more easily, and lower IQ types can flee and break and run and change sides much more easily. But if you look at our wars in Southern Africa, where we also had Western interference, where the West would apply sanctions and threaten sanctions on us if we did this and if we did that, by having that kind of lack of support for ourselves, it meant that there were many times when we could have landed punches on our enemies, like really landed flipping punches on our enemies in a big way. where we had the means to do it and we didn't do it. And we towed the line that you only do the minimum of what you need in order to keep the enemy at bay. And when you fight like that, when you do the minimum to keep the enemy at bay, then all that you're doing is you are doing the things that are weakening our morale and you are strengthening the enemy's morale. If you don't hit the enemy with everything you have and you are always pulling your punches, then all that happens is that the enemy then starts sensing this. And they will most likely just assume that you are too weak to do it, which is absolutely the worst thing you'd want them to think. But they probably, in all likelihood, will. And even if they do sense that you've got the means to do it, but that you are holding back, then they will sense that you are afraid for some reason. And that's also not good. So for us in Southern Africa, by pulling our punches and always trying to keep it within certain bounds, we were demoralizing ourselves because we feel now that we are never going to get to the end of this war, that this war is going to carry on forever and ever. Our opponents, on the other hand, are going to be emboldened because even though they can't pack a punch to knock us out or to inflict massive damage on us, they do feel that they've got us in a spot and they just need to carry on plugging away. Fighting a low-intensity war and keeping it low-intensity is the worst thing you can possibly do. It's the absolute worst thing you can possibly do. Because all it does is it drains your morale and it strengthens their morale. And if you carry on doing this for long enough, their human ability to adapt to the pain that you can inflict on them continuously improves. Whereas what you need to do is you need to overload them. The other term to keep in mind is overloading. The real goal that you want to do is to overload their system. You need to overload their system with so much input in terms of firepower, pain, suffering, all kinds of misery. You want to overload them so that they can't take it anymore. You've got to try and make their lives a living hell, and then they will quit. And all kinds of misery and pain and suffering is what you need to be dishing out to the enemy in large quantities. If you don't do that, you're not going to get to the end of the conflict. In order to win, you have to break your enemy and you have to break their structures. You have to make it so that everybody starts saying, you know what, it's better to surrender. Let's just have peace at any price. You want your enemy to be thinking like that. Peace at any price. We'll do anything for peace. Just give us peace. And that is the key to this whole issue. And that is why any kind of talk of ceasefires, slowing things down, peacekeeping forces, all of that stuff is rubbish. Because all that you're doing is that you are buying time for the other side, and the other side gets time to prepare, and then the fighting continues again. It is better to keep hammering away and not stopping, because ultimately that is even going to save lives. Because if you fight a bit and then you stop and then you fight a bit and then you stop and you carry on like that for enough years and decades, eventually more people will be killed than would have been killed if you'd just gone in and pounded the hell out of them in the beginning. So overloading human systems is very important. Now this same kind of stuff also happens in politics. It happens in other interactions with other races, where people slow down their efforts and then people think, oh, it's better if things are done more slowly. But it's wrong. You actually need to ramp up your efforts. In any kind of conflict, the goal must be to make it so that the other side can't take it anymore and they break. And everybody has got a breaking point. Everyone has a breaking point. There's nobody who's immune to this. But if you do things slowly and you fumble and bumble around, then you'll see that it just never comes to an end because humans are adaptable and you are giving them time to adapt and then they'll carry on with their shit. If you want to get a problem solved quickly, you have to move fast and you have to overload their system as quickly as possible in every conceivable way. And that's why also the most effective armies and the most effective battles are ones where the one side is moving faster than the other, is outthinking them, outmaneuvering them, and catching them off guard and doing all kinds of unexpected and nasty things. Obviously, if you can kill more people quicker, that helps a lot. That is critical. If you can kill more faster, that helps. That's hugely helpful. But even if you can't outright just kill them that quickly, you can do other things that can make life a living hell. In military and government strategy, you can make other moves that also hurt them. Cut off supplies to armies, cause armies to be without food, then they may surrender en masse, that kind of thing. But your goal is to inflict as much pain as you can on the biggest scale that you can, as quickly as you can, and in ways that add to all kinds of mental and physical strain. Much of the time, mental strain alone is going to be the winner. If you can make them feel crazy to the point where they can't handle it anymore, then they will quit. Warfare is about getting your way regardless of how the opponent feels about it. The opponent can hate you to high heaven, but if you keep hurting him enough, then he'll quit. At the end of the day, this is nothing to do with making friends and that kind of thing. When you are really fighting someone for a serious reason, let's say a racial reason, then your goal is to win, and he must come groveling to you. It's not about friendship, it's not about any kind of positive human emotion. It is about power. It is about power, and you bring them to their knees. That is the only way that you do this. This is tried and tested. It's worked for thousands of years. That's how you do it. And so any kind of cabinet war kind of thing, slow kind of thing, stuff where we do low intensity, all of that is rubbish. All of that stuff is rubbish. The goal must just be inflict pain to the maximum of the maximum that you can manage. Do it as fast as possible. Do it in the most unpleasant way that you possibly can. That's the only way that you get results. And the results come quickly. As you saw in those later videos, when one side was breaking through and had the means to hit the other one, either with another weapon like those drones, or in the case of Syria, we had multiple different military forces all attacking and fighting in different places, but hitting the Syrian army. The Syrian army clearly got overloaded. And the Syrian army, when it got overloaded, it was starting to break down completely. In my 50 years of race war in Southern Africa, I pointed out the battle of Kuito Kuanavali that South Africa fought in Angola. And in that battle, the South African army started causing the other side to break up completely. However, the mistake is that the government didn't have the will, etc., to turn this into a huge, huge victory. That is where Napoleon would not have wasted a minute. Napoleon was perfectly placed for that kind of thing. The moment the enemy army starts breaking up, that's when Napoleon's cavalry would be out there. They'd be hunting them down, breaking them up, seeing to it that they carry on running, keep them running, stop them from having even a short while to gather together and to reform themselves as a unit. Napoleon had this stuff down to a T. When Napoleon went into a fight, he was aiming to break that army and get the army on the run. And once the army starts breaking and it's on the run, that's when all his other things kick in, especially his cavalry. And his cavalry is out there. And the cavalry chase them and hunt them down day after day. They don't give them a minute's rest. They hunt them down. They don't give that army that's been broken up, they don't give it the slightest chance to rest. Napoleon's troops, once their cavalry was on the go, hunting down the broken remains of an army, The goal was to keep them on the run and keep on their toes so that those guys don't get 30 minutes or don't get an hour or a day in which to rest and start gathering themselves together in order to make another stand. The goal was hunt them down, get them to surrender or shoot them, keep them on the run at the very least, and keep them split apart so that they don't reform as an army. If you leave them alone for a day or two, then huge chunks of those troops will be able to get together and will be able to reform units. They'll be able to create ad hoc units, and they'll be able to start fighting back. Even if they can't defeat your army, they'll be able to slow your army down. So you don't want to do any of that stuff. You want to keep them on the run. You want to keep them running for days, if possible. And the cavalry would just hunt them down for as long as they could. They'd chase them long distances and keep them going. Because that is when the rest of the army can then advance quickly. And in warfare, when you get the thing right, things move really fast. Things can move really, really fast. As that guy pointed out regarding Libya, that once the one side started breaking through due to the drones, they were able to advance and undo what the other side had achieved in 6 years. They could do in 1 week what the other side couldn't do in 6 years. Warfare, when done properly, goes really, really fast. And you want to keep it fast. You want to keep full pressure on, maximum speed, as long as possible, as fast as possible, in order to get your goal. Because any kind of slowing things down is all bad for you. Any kind of slowing things down is all bad. You need to get your enemy's mind totally freaked out, totally tired, worn out, freaked out, despondent, and you want to keep it that way. And you don't want to give them time to recover from that. You've got to make them so worn out that they make all the wrong decisions, make all the wrong moves. And of course, if you defeat an army, you get an army on the run, then it has an impact on the rest of the people and on the leadership of the country. For a military force to rule the civilians is a piece of cake. The civilians don't stand a chance, and the civilians can be mowed down easily. So the main goal is get rid of the enemy army. The enemy army is your main opponent. Once you've got them out the way, you're good to go. I just want to mention that tribal war that you saw and all the noise that they were making. Many times, noise is good as a psychological thing, and more primitive armies will use that. Even the Confederates used noise as a psychological weapon. There's a thing known as the rebel yell. And the thing about noise is that noise draws attention, and noise can unsettle you. Interestingly enough, when I was at Churchill School in Rhodesia, we had a strange thing that we did at the school. I don't know if other schools in South Africa did similar things, or whether American schools have got something like that, maybe for certain sports. But in our school, we had a thing called a war cry. And the boys would have to go out, we'd have to go out and we'd have to do this war cry. And they had this war cry with all kinds of nonsensical words. The words didn't have any meaning, but you had to chant it in a certain way. And I must tell you that a school of 1,000 white boys, when we chanted, we made a huge noise. And that noise is very powerful as a means of communicating to the other side and communicating to your side. I have done a bit of research, and it seems that American schools, some American schools and colleges, have got similar kinds of thing. It's called a fight song or a school chant or a school cheer. And they've also got styles of clapping, etc. So there are things that people chant, like go, Tigers, fight, win, score again, that kind of thing. We had something similar, and I must tell you, it is a very impressive thing. So in certain military situations in the past, it's the kind of thing that was used. The Confederates had the rebel yell, and that thing is meant to make noise and make the enemy hear something that sounds scary. It's a psychological tool. Also similar to the Stuka dive bomber, which makes a specific noise. That noise is also intended to scare the other side. So those tribes and all that noise that they're making, the noise is meant to intimidate the other side, etc. But the Romans and the Greeks, I don't think, used that kind of thing. Descriptions of battles among the ancient Greeks indicated that the battles were rather quiet, that there was a strange kind of a grunting and so forth that carried on. Possibly they were just focused on the fighting, and they also need to be able to take orders, because orders are important. So if the whole army is making noise, then they can't hear the orders from their commanders. Their commanders are there in their ranks, and the commanders are issuing orders to them during the battles. So descriptions of ancient Greek fighting was that it's a very nasty kind of a grunting thing as the men are fighting. It's not intended to be noisy. And the Roman army also was specifically a very quiet army. The Roman army was totally silent because the Roman army was even more flexible, and the Roman army operated in a totally different way. And its flexibility meant that it made all kinds of changes and maneuvers. And so the guys had to be able to hear their commanders. The Roman army was known for its silence. But psychological warfare is also part of the scaring thing. And something you should keep in mind, remember what Nietzsche said. Nietzsche said, "That which does not kill you makes you stronger." That which doesn't kill you makes you stronger, which just brings us back to that whole business that if you fight wars slowly, if you give an enemy a chance to get used to you, then you are just making your enemy stronger. If you really want effect, you got to move with speed. Now, the only time that we would ever want any kind of ceasefire during a war is if we are losing. That would be the only time you'd ever want a ceasefire. And if your enemy is stupid enough to give it to you, then that would be good for us. In the Rhodesian War in the mid-1970s, when South Africa and America got involved there, they came up with this idea of a ceasefire. That was the worst thing they ever did. And this is why politics does not mix with war. The two things are totally different. In politics, you're looking for people to make deals with you. In warfare, you don't care. You are going to crush them and make them do what you want them to do. You'll see that whenever you mix politics with warfare, it's always a disaster. It's never good. You need to keep politics out of warfare and focus on the fighting. Speed is a very critical part of warfare. Speed is very, very important. And whenever a side can, they must move with the utmost speed. A combination of speed and secrecy is absolutely fantastic, because speed helps to mess up so many things. And if they start winning and they hit somebody in an unexpected way, they can make huge amounts of progress before the other side's generals and top commanders know how serious the situation is. And among the things that you want to do with psychological warfare and those kinds of things is you want the enemy to feel that the situation is hopeless, even if it isn't. Even if the situation for them isn't hopeless, you want them to feel that it's hopeless, that all forms of resistance is a waste of time. Another thing about the wars in Europe and most of our wars, because most of our really nasty wars have been between each other, the one thing that we've always at least done is we've always at least adhered to the concept of not killing women and children, except now in some of the nonsense that happened in World War II with all the bombings and things, Dresden and the nasty, nasty bombings. But as a general rule, in our wars, we don't kill women and children most of the time. And in ancient times, the men would even take women from the conquered nation as their wives. So they're actually taking other white women as their wives, and then they're going to have children with them in their tribe or their society. So that was a good side of the war, that we don't slaughter the women and children, and in many, many cases, women even become wives and mothers to other whites, and they then become part of that tribe or nation in the future. But when you are dealing with other races, you really don't want interbreeding with those other races. So there are levels of morality that can be changed. When you are dealing with another race, you can really take the gloves off and do anything you want, because most of the time, you probably don't want those people in your society anyway. So when it comes to racial conflict, the rules can be very different. But the key thing that you have that will measure whether you are making headway, the key thing that will allow you to know whether you are doing the right thing, is when you see your enemy showing signs of pain and weakness. Especially if the enemy starts wanting to do things like having peace talks or wanting ceasefires, or they are complaining about the pain that they are going through, or you are seeing people defecting. If you see people defecting, more people surrendering. It is when you see the structure itself starting to crumble, when you see morale going down, people starting to question things, people starting to run away, people starting to surrender more, people coming to want to talk to you about peace. When you see all these signs that indicate pain and weakness and suffering, then you know you're onto the right thing. Then you know that you're onto the right thing, and that in order to win, you must just push harder. So when you see the signs of pain and breakdown of the structure, and even maybe rebellion and other people inside the system speaking out against the system, when you see all these things where you see that the people are not sticking together, then you know you're doing it right. You must do more of the same. And you mustn't slow down. You must speed up. And of course, any enemy, any nation, and any army has got specific weaknesses. And that's the other thing, is if you are fighting them, you are also looking for what are their greatest weaknesses, and hit them where it hurts, and hit them even more where it hurts. You don't want to let up. If you don't do these things, then you're not going to be able to win. The whole thing is about inflicting pain and suffering. And when you see signs of breakdown, the key measurement you need to look at are signs of breaking down. If they are breaking down, that's when you must ramp it up even more. That is your key measurement. When you see that they are breaking, that their minds and spirits are breaking, that's your key measurement that you are winning, man. And you need to ramp that thing up as much as possible. Rhodesia, at a point, was getting to that. We will discuss South Africa as a separate topic. But in South Africa, you had other thinking, non-military thinking. But if you want to win in military terms, you've got to inflict pain. You've got to inflict pain in a big way. And once that structure starts crumbling, it'll just crumble more. Once the process of crumbling starts, it just gets worse. And the only thing that stops it falling apart is when you ease off the pressure. When you ease off the pressure, then you give them time to rest and recover, and they will. So if you want to win, you need to ramp it up and keep the pressure on and increase the pressure and hit more. And try every freaking thing that you can. Because if you don't do that, you're just wasting your time and you're going to allow them to escape out of the trap. Warfare is the opposite of business. It's not about talking and reaching agreements. It's about winning. And the white man has won so many times. And the white man needs to learn how to win. And it's not about worrying whether they're going to love you or hate you, etc. If they hate you, they're going to have to fight you and beat you. They can hate you as much as they want. But if they can't beat you, then their hatred has little to no meaning to you. And that's the way whites need to think. The Romans engaged in 1,200 years of war. They fought hundreds of wars. And they are the greatest political and military structure that we ever had. And it is not that they broke down, that the system failed. Hitler himself says at a point, I think in Hitler's table talk, he says that he doesn't see any reason why the legions couldn't carry on advancing. Among the negative things that happened in the Roman Empire was the advent of Christianity. And the early Christians were a bunch of peaceniks. They were a bunch of hippies, actually. The original Christians were a bunch of hippies, and they didn't want to fight for Rome. So they were completely different to the rest of the Romans. The things that undermined Rome came from all kinds of silly things. The Romans did not collapse because they were just losing wars. The things that weakened the Romans were things that came from inside their system. Those were the things that weakened the Romans. If their system had remained firm, they would have just carried on. For us in Africa, we were caught off guard by our enemies. That's all. They came and they found our weak spot. And our weak spot was a dependence on another race. A huge dependence on another race, and they were able to exploit that. But the key measurement to watch is stuff that indicates signs of pain and internal breakdown. And this applies also to the way that we deal with other races in our interactions. If you don't see signs of fear and unhappiness, then you know that they are still standing strong. But if you see them doing other stuff and people starting to run away, then you know, okay. If you see physical signs of lower morale, more unhappiness among them, and them starting to run away or change sides or do weird things, then you know you're onto something. But it's a ruthless game, and that's the way you win. And all kinds of other weird things don't have any of the results and success that you get out of this system. This is the way to fight war. That's what you aim for. And your goal is to ultimately get them to the point where they can't take it anymore and they want peace at any price. They'll give you anything that you want. That's how you get it. The reason for focusing on the enemy army is because that's where your main opposition is going to be. You won't be able to do anything easily until you can defeat the enemy army. But once that army starts going down, capturing the people is a piece of cake. Capturing the people or even genociding the people is a piece of cake. Then it's easy peasy. There's no one to resist you. You can do anything you want. But that is the way, the ruthless way, that you win wars and you get to a outcome, a result that has meaning. And if it's done properly and well planned, it can even go very quickly, very quickly. Just like the decisive campaign in France in 1940. But there are many, many examples of really quick wars where things went really fast. But you need to get away from cabinet war type thinking, low intensity war type thinking. That type of thinking is a waste of time because you're not going to be able to get anything that has meaning. If you want to win, you've got to go out and fight and win. You've got to do like our ancestors, whether it was the Aryans or other whites or the Greeks or the Romans. In the end, it was big fight, big battles, big fights, get the thing over, crack them, and so forth. But the key to it is to get to the point where the humans on the other side are starting to weaken, starting to break. That's your real measurement of whether you are making headway. And you should look at the stuff that we do in politics as well and take a look at our enemies in politics and cultural things and look and see if they're taking strain or not. Because the same stuff applies there, that if they're not showing signs of strain and pain and giving in, then it means that things are too easy and it's going too well for them. And people keep thinking that you need to go back and you need to talk and you need to negotiate and you need to do this and you need to do that. But our ancestors used to simply win outright. They win outright, they win, and they get all the goodies. And it's a much more sensible way to approach it. And you get a decisive result, you get exactly what you want, you win everything, winner takes all, they are defeated, you do as you please. Because when you win in that way, then you get to do as you please, and you can do anything that you want with the defeated. And white men really need to win, and really need to win big again. What's holding us back is all kinds of junk thinking, junk morality. We've got all kinds of junk thinking that slows us down. We could win outright literally everywhere. We could just win outright everywhere. And if we in Southern Africa didn't have other whites threatening us with sanctions, threatening us with this and that, and we'd just gone and done what we wanted to do, we would have easily sorted out our problems. But being nice, being soft, is not the right stuff for war. You've got to be hard, you've got to be ruthless, you've got to be unrelenting. And the only thing that you want at the end of the day is you want victory. We in Southern Africa had a stupid boast. And at the time, we thought it was a good boast. Our boast was that we won all the battles, but we lost the war. It's actually a very stupid boast because it shows that we weren't doing it right. Yeah, we could win the battles, but if you've won all the battles, you should have won the war. So how come you didn't win the war? And then it boils down to the fact that you weren't ruthless enough. That's really what it boils down to. The Romans had an opposite boast. The Romans boasted that they might lose battles, but they never lose a war. So the Romans might lose battles, but they never lose the war. That's a much better boast. And if you look at the foreign policy of the United States and the West, we are so weak. And all of our weakness comes from our heads. It comes from Jewry. It comes from liberalism. We are thinking like idiots when in fact we've got tons and tons of tools and our methods work. Our systems work perfectly. Our methods worked for thousands of years, and they will continue to work for thousands of years more. And humans today are no different to humans 1,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago. The same things that worked in the past will work in the future. If people want to fight us, we just got to beat them into submission, and they'll be in their place just like in the past. Everything that's going wrong with us is in our heads. All of our mistakes are in our heads. It's not in our tools. It's not in our bodies. It's in our heads. If we just think differently and use tried and tested methods from the past, everything will work. And nowadays, we've got even more tools than we ever had in the past. But the key thing to remember is you need to see and look for signs of weakness and signs of breakage in the enemy. And if you see that, then you know you're doing the right thing. Just ramp the damn thing up and defeat them. So let me leave you with my signature video. I like my signature video. I think it's a flipping awesome video. because we want to see that style of Wehrmacht Roman Army back in the future on steroids, winning like crazy. Thank you very much for listening today. I hope that you learned something new today. Look after yourselves and take care. We'll be chatting again soon.
Give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win. Every fight you fight, every game you play, you will reach the top. At the top, that is where you will stay.